Good morning. This is Good in a Crisis, I think, number 6. And with me today I have Daisy Comfort Angel, who is the team leader of...
The Retreats. Okay,
who is it? We got in contact a few weeks ago when you emailed me out the blue to ask about Dollhouse and what we were doing with opening up after lockdown. And I then found out about your service. So tell me what you do.
So I did email you out the blue. It was a bit of a surprise email, I guess. I'm the team leader of the retreats in Dorset. We have 2 retreats, one in Dorchester and one in Bournemouth. They're a partnership project with Dorset Mental Health Forum and Dorset Healthcare NHS. I took over this role in December as team leader. And previously, I've worked as a mental health nurse at the retreats and also in inpatient services, dementia services and mum and baby, which is really exciting. So I'm a qualified nurse. I've been qualified for 6 years now, and to think then, and I just absolutely loved the idea of a crisis cafe where people could self-define the crisis, it being measured, not being measured by professionals, but by them. And the idea of a partnership project being completely set up with Dorset Mental Health Forum and peer specialists, I just loved it. So that's why I've chosen to continue to work at the retreats, and the values and the ethos of the service are just so empowering for people and also for the staff team. That's what we do. We were based on Dollhouse and how they work, and actually I think there was a lot of visits and communication with Dollhouse before we set up, but the philosophy of Dollhouse is what we tried to carry over and continue with the retreats.
I was looking at the website earlier on and it surprised me how much felt just like Dollhouse. There were comments like, when people arrive, you're greeted at the door, they make you a hot drink and then show you around. And I thought, that's exactly what we do as well. When people come in, it's not like, oh, are you expected? Have you got an appointment? It's much more, oh, come in, this is the living room. Do you want to have a seat? What can I get you to drink?
It's trying to be welcoming, isn't it? If it's for people in a crisis. There's so many barriers with being a clinical and formal, I think, for people, that actually just being welcoming in itself is really positive and relaxing and just helps that person feel at ease. It's essential.
Yeah. So some things I've noticed is like that it's quite an attractive building. There's a nice video on YouTube. And Dollhouse is also quite an attractive building rather than a clinical looking building. Although yours is really big, so you can get many more people in there than we can.
Yeah, we're really lucky with our building. So it is a beautiful building, which has a lot of space. We've got a really nice relaxation room at the back. The cafe space is quite big. Then we've got a really nice big group room. We've also got a really lovely garden in the summer, which is wonderful.
So how many people do you see on a nightly basis?
I'd say on average in the East and Bournemouth retreat, we probably see about 35 people a night. And in Dorchester, it's a little bit lower, so we probably see about 12 people a night.
People don't need to phone up like they do for Dollhouse. They can just turn up, right?
Absolutely, they can just turn up. So with us, you just turn up at the door. Yeah, no referrals. No referrals, just turn up. I think that's really nice that you've got that opportunity to define your crisis, come in when you want to, and it not having to wait, not having to meet certain criteria for it, and just being able to go there when you need to.
I know that waiting for us to phone back after people have given referral is often described as being a really difficult period, not knowing if you're going to be able to come in or not. So it does sound really desirable that people can just turn up. I think we did do that in the past, but because Dollhouse is basically a big house, it's not, you know, like a clinic sort of size or mansion, it's just a large house. It didn't take very long before it got full up, and it just wasn't practical to have people turning up at the door the whole time.
I can see where, like, if you're struggling and you're calling up for support and then you're having to wait to hear back how that's going to go, it could be really tricky. But also your building is very different, isn't it? And it's really homely.
It's very homely. Yeah, I mean, many people say they'd just like to live there. They don't want to go home at the end of the night. You have a lot of interaction with emergency services as well. I have quite a lot of people brought by ambulance and the police.
We do, yeah, we do. So rather than being taken to hospital, people can just come to us. So emergency services can utilise the retreats as an alternative or somewhere else to bring someone. I think it's a much nicer environment for people. It's where it's very, it's not clinical. It's just you can come in and use the space, and that's up to you how you use it. And we're there to sit with you.
And what's your sort of criteria for people being dropped off by ambulances? Is there anyone that you wouldn't accept?
We try really hard not to have criteria, but it'd be if you need medical treatment, which we wouldn't be able to do, or if you're really drunk, then we probably wouldn't. And again, if you don't want to be with us, we're not going to force you to come in.
Sure. So you said really drunk. So does that mean if someone's had a few, but they can still engage, that's fine?
Yes. Yeah, so if you can still hold a conversation with us to a level where it's going to be helpful, then yeah, absolutely, you can still come in. I think it's really important that we remember that although alcohol's bad for mental health, it's still a really normal part of most people's lives.
Mm. Yeah, a major coping strategy for a lot of people as well. Yeah, so that again, that sounds, that philosophy is the same as with us as well. Absolutely, if people have had a few, they can come if they need. I mean, a lot of people use drink to manage, like hearing voices, for example. So to say to people you couldn't drink before you come would just stop them from being able to use the service. And also, if somebody drinks quite a lot every day, they may be the amount that might cause me to be drunk, they might be totally functional and other people wouldn't really notice.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons to be tolerant of people having had something.
It took me a little bit of time to get my head around it as well. Coming from obviously clinical environments where everything's very restricted, to being able to go, that's fine, yeah, that's okay. You have had a drink, you can still come in and use my service.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to grasp that that's okay. I don't know why, but it did.
So in my understanding is in the NHS, for example, unless I guess it's a specific drug and alcohol service, you wouldn't be allowed to use most services if you were intoxicated.
You'd almost be penalised as well. So if you continue to use drugs, you continue to drink, actually we won't be able to continue working with you, is what a lot of services sort of say, isn't it?
Mm.
And actually your primary problem's alcohol, so we can't sit with that. Or we won't be able to work therapeutically with you, which isn't what the retreat does. It's actually going, well, this is you. This is who you are, and actually that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. So yeah, it was a big change, a big adjustment.
So in terms of structure, your services are a partnership between the NHS and Dorset Mental Health Forum, which is a third sector organisation. So I guess the NHS must have more influence in how you practice than, say, with us. We're completely independent, although we're funded by a CCG.
I'll be honest, I haven't actually faced them struggles. And it might be because we were already set up and established when I started working. I think there is still quite a lot of confusion from other professionals within the NHS as to how we don't document as thoroughly as other services do, and how we do see people who are intoxicated and that's okay, and how we do continue to see people repeatedly and not have set goals or criteria for people to meet before they can see us again.
Hmm.
I think a lot of people struggle with that, but this all came from the acute care pathway review, which was heavily influenced by what the feedback was from what people wanted. And that's what people wanted, was a drop-in service where this was okay and the focus wasn't on paperwork.
You know, is it what we try to provide? And it sounds like that's exactly what you do as well. I mean, I'm amazed how much of what you say sounds exactly like what we do.
That's really nice to hear, because a lot of what we've done is based on how you work and the successes that you have as a service.
Mm. I noticed that your requirement is people have to be over 18 to use the service, because ours is 16. So,
is it? Mm. I couldn't tell you the exact reasons why, but because we're an adult service and in Dorset healthcare, adults are over 18. If you're under 18, you'll be under the children and adolescent service. Couldn't tell you actually why. I think there is discussions, and the idea of broadening out and having a young person service similar to what we offer would be absolutely amazing. I think people are really passionate about obtaining that. It'd be amazing if we could work with people who were in that I'm going to say transition period, I guess. I think when you're 16 going on to 18 19 20, there's a lot of changes.
Yeah.
You're like, again, going back to alcohol, you start drinking at 16, don't you? And what does that
not legally, what does that do? Legally you don't.
Legally, you start at 18. I'm sorry. And also, like, all your hormones that are going on, and what does that look like when you're then giving all this more responsibility, yet all the pressures from school and exams? And I think it'd be really interesting to be able to support people, to be able to sit and understand what's going on. Mm. And also transition period, again, between child and adolescent services and adult services. There's lots of, it's huge. And I think lots of people really struggle with the big changes that there are. So when I talk to our younger people who use the service, the changes in the approach used by children and adolescents to adult services are so massive and significant that it's really confusing and scary. Offering a place for people to sit with that and go, yeah, I am moving, and what does this look like, and how can I interpret it, and just be in a safe space to reflect on that.
Yeah. We also, actually, I don't know if you know, but we've just started a young person service as well. So we've now got one that's basically Dale House for young people, and it's called Safe Zone. You can go there from the age of 11.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Mm. Do you find there's much challenges with your, just out of curiosity, sorry, with having people who are 16 to 18 using your service with, like, safeguarding or anything like that, or is it just continuous as in it's...
We do have to be a bit more proactive with safeguarding type things. Obviously, if somebody's under the age of 18, there's less leeway for them to decide what outcome they want, because they're still legally a child. But in terms of their interactions with us, it's like everything else. You treat somebody like an adult, like a human being, and they respond that way, I think. So, I mean, a lot of our work tends to be more pastoral, is that the word? You know, sort of like, yeah. There's an obvious, like, adult, not so much adult-child dynamic, but more of a big brother or a big sister dynamic. With some of the older female staff that we have, there have been a few times when obvious sort of mother-daughter bonds have started to be created. But, I mean, that's not something I necessarily see as unhealthy, as long as everybody's aware of it and we remain boundary. It can be that we're providing an attachment that was lacking that's still very much needed. And, like, this is something you mentioned before about the fact that people can come back and can keep coming back and build an attachment to the service and the staff. It's something that we do see as important, that that's there, and it is open-ended. So you're very much an open-ended service like us as well.
Yeah, no end date. Keep coming.
Hmm.
We received a feedback the other day, which was really nice to receive, saying how that open-ended, not having time limits, really allowed this lady to explore her recovery and explore her coping strategies and not feel like she was pressured. She spoke about the language of risk, not having to use, like, risk language, which she was so used to using within services, because we're still here. You still come back, and it wouldn't be about her escalating or feeling like she needs to escalate to receive support. She felt that she could use this for safety.
Mm.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Really nice to read. Really nice.
So, I mean, people should be able to come somewhere and not feel the pressure to move on. And, you know, I've got somebody doing some building next door by the sound of it. I don't know if you can hear that tapping. That's good. So there's often so much pressure to move on. There's always these outcomes when you use services, and you're expected to move across a graph, whereas, you know, we're happy for people to come back and still be in the same emotional place. Staff sometimes might struggle a bit with it, and, you know, in supervision and so on, talk about their frustrations with their own personal frustrations with some visitors seemingly in the same place after a certain amount of time. But that's what that space in supervision is for, because people need to be able to move at their own speed and not feel forced to move.
That's such a different approach, isn't it? Because I think there's a lot of personal feelings when you're working as a nurse, that if someone isn't moving on or isn't getting better or doesn't seem to be behaving in a way that you'd be expecting following the intervention you've been providing, that you feel like you're failing, or yeah, they're failing you. And I mean, that's really negative, isn't it? It's such a negative feeling to be having. And utilising and sitting within yourself, but working in this way and being able to change that perception so that you go, actually, they're doing the best they can do at this point in time, and let's just sit with that and let's give them time and let them take the lead rather than it being me dictating. It's just so empowering, and that change in dynamic and work, it's, well, difficult, but absolutely amazing. Also, how awful is it when you go to someone like, well, you need to do this, this, and this. They haven't done it. They probably feel like they're failing as well, and that's not fair because we're setting unrealistic goals and expectations when that person's not in either of that place of change or can't at that moment. And there's lots of other stuff going on. And actually, just being able to sit with someone and go, it's okay to feel like this, and we can sit there and feel like that.
It's very hard to do, though. I mean, it sounds simple, doesn't it, that you just stay with where somebody's at? But I mean, I've been doing this work for about 12 years now, and and I still every shift see staff struggling to stay in exactly that place where the person is.
It's so hard, and I think it's just checking in on yourself all the time, isn't it? I absolutely love the values and the way the retreat works, but hands up, it's the hardest job I've done. Hardest job, because you are sitting and being, and it feels like you're not doing. It feels like you're taking on a lot of their emotions, isn't it? Because you're being really vulnerable in yourself. And that's really positive, but it's really difficult to sit with. And you're right, that's where supervision is so important. So yeah, we do really regular, I'm sure you do as well, is really the debriefs throughout your shift. So if you have a conversation with someone, you go, I'm really angry, or I feel this, you own it, you talk about it, you move forward.
Absolutely. If we didn't have that space to express that stuff, it would just come out somehow in the interaction with the person that we're supposed to be supporting.
Yeah.
I wanted to acknowledge some other minor difference between our services. So everybody who works for us is what you would call a peer. I mean, the term we use is survivor-led. I think it's effectively the same thing. It's the people here have lived experience and are drawing on that experience in the work. But your organisation is slightly different, isn't it? Can you describe that?
Yeah, so we are run, when on shifts, we have mental health practitioners who are a qualified member of staff, so nurses, social workers, occupational therapists, peer specialists who have the lived experience. And then we also have a NHS member of staff who's a front of house who does the welcoming and the meet and greet. So it is very different because we do have that professional experience alongside that lived experience. And it's a completely joint way of working. Everyone's valued as who they are and what skills they bring individually, not your rank or your registration or how long you've had a mental illness for. It's not done like that.
So is there a difference in responsibilities on shift?
Risk-wise, yes. As a mental health practitioner, you are responsible for the shift following your registration, but you're also, so if there is a situation where someone needs to go to hospital or we need to refer them to the home treatment team, or you feel that actually there's a very high risk in this situation that needs to be mitigated, then that's where the mental health practitioner will come in. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't be doing it. A peer specialist couldn't sit there and say exactly the same as what that mental health practitioner would say. The mental health practitioner just sits with that and owns that risk and makes sure that plan sits in with Dorset Healthcare and where the organisation would sit with it.
Yeah, okay. So I'd maybe thought before that the peer specialist wouldn't be doing the more risky work, but it sounds like it's just that the mental health practitioner is like the buck stops with them. They're the ones that sort of signs off on what's going on at the end of the night.
Absolutely. I've had really good conversations actually where I've been in difficult situations where I've really struggled with sitting with making a plan with this person or moving forward and me feeling really uncomfortable with that risk, like personally. And I've called in and asked for some support from one of our peer specialists. And do you know what? Just completely changed them. And the way that they interacted, yeah, we still came to the same outcome and same decision, but it was just so empowering having that extra support from the peer specialist, and the way that worked and the way they engaged and the way they viewed it was very different to how I viewed it. Also, if we have like someone coming in with emergency services, it doesn't need to be a practitioner who sees them. It could be whoever's best for that person.
So it's a true multidisciplinary team that you've got, by the sound of it.
Yeah, completely. I think everyone's just completely bought into the values of this way of working.
Should we sort of finish just talking about like lockdown and what your plans are for easing?
Gosh, about easing lockdown. Wow, it's really difficult, isn't it? We're currently just doing digital one-to-ones using Attend Anywhere. We're also having very few face-to-face appointments because there's such a big issue with people who can't use technology or don't like technology, and that we don't want to exclude people. So we'll have face-to-face appointments, and emergency services can bring people in. And we're also doing webinars, so skill-based webinars, which explain like why. So we do the window of tolerance is a really good webinar of looking at the window of tolerance, why it's important, why we talk about it a lot, and where you sit with it. So that's recovery-based, so recovery education-based. And all of our webinars are co-produced with a peer specialist and a mental health practitioner. I'm really hoping we can start having some small groups of people coming in at some point, but we're just waiting on a bit more guidance from other services, but also looking at how we can open up that like place to just be. And what does that mean? Because I think that's a really important part of our service, is having a space to just come, to be, to sit. But how can we do that digitally? Because, I mean, the guidance is stay home where possible. So how can you digitally create a space like that, and a safe space for people to be in? And that's sort of our next steps that we're going to look at. Yeah.
I find it reassuring to hear that you're in a similar kind of place to us. Because like you say, the guidance isn't terribly clear on what we're supposed to be doing.
And it's really frustrating, isn't it? Because you sort of want to go, well, the pubs are open, so I can have everyone back in and we can start working in the way that we want to work. But you can't, especially with track and trace and putting people at risk. And where does that sit with working with people? That's why I emailed you in the first place, because I was getting a bit worried about what other crisis services were doing and what we weren't doing, and how did that sit, and how were people planning next steps?
Track and trace is an interesting one, because I don't know, how are you with confidentiality? Because for us, confidentiality is a big thing. Like, we say to people, if you come here, we're not going to tell anyone that you've come here. It won't go on your GP record or anything like that. If other professionals ring up and say, has so-and-so used your service? We'd say, you need to ask them about that. Unless it was the police who was looking for a missing person, for example. Obviously, we'd cooperate with that. But everything else would be like, you know, it's their data. We're not going to share it willy-nilly.
That's really different. I imagine that's the NHS side of us, because we put everyone's attendance on their clinical records.
Wow.
So we don't know. Yeah, so if you come into our building, unless you give a fake name, we'll put you on our clinical records. So we won't necessarily put in the conversation or the details of the conversation that you've had. It would just be that you've received peer support, you've used the cafe. And if there is anything of note that we need to document or share with CMHTs, we would do. But again, we'd be having really honest conversations about that. It wouldn't be, we're going to refer you or email your community mental health team without talking to you. But yeah, that's really different to what you do. We share a lot of information with police as well, and they share information back with us if deemed necessary. That's very different.
What sort of information is shared between you and police?
Risk information a lot of the time. So because, again, we're an open door service, sometimes we have people coming in who do pose quite a significant risk, but we don't have all that information. And looking at how we can facilitate them using the service, but also maintaining safety, and what is that, and how do we work with that? Well, just being aware, I think, is really empowering for people. But also, if the police would like to, say they've got someone who's they're trying to find or trying to source some more resources for, we could share a little bit of information as appropriate with them. So we've got a close link with police officers in both areas. But the information we share is very limited and very specific to what's needed. We wouldn't just be sharing everything about people, obviously. But yeah, working really closely with other organisations.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's times when it'd be really useful for us to be able to put notes on people's records.
I mean, we don't look at notes. So if you come in, we wouldn't have looked at all of your notes from previous. We wouldn't have looked at your entries from before that you've used us. We wouldn't look at your risk assessment unless there was a need to, we wouldn't look at it.
Okay, so you've got access to like face risks, things like that, but you don't routinely check them. That's very interesting.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it, because it's such a NHS way of working, or a nurse way of working, is I'm going to look at your notes and then go and talk to you about your notes.
Yeah
like I'll write a list of questions about your notes to ask you. But how can you meet someone where they are if you're going in with a judgment already?
Absolutely. So was this a conscious decision then, that like we won't be checking notes before having it. Right, okay.
Yes, it was a conscious decision.
Brilliant. Oh, yeah. I like that.
Yes, yeah, so it's there if we need it, but we try not to.
Hmm. So I guess because you've got, so is this Paris or something like that that you can do?
We use Rio.
Oh, is that the similar kind of thing?
Probably.
Okay. Round here, people talk about Paris a lot, but so
I imagine so.
So I mean, something we do if we're concerned about somebody is we might contact the crisis team. We try and get the person's permission to do this first, but we might ring them and say, "Look, so and so's with us, and we're concerned about how they are tonight. You know, this is their presentation. What would you recommend?" So I guess you wouldn't really need to do that because you could just look on the system and find out like the latest CPA, whatever.
Yeah. So if it, I guess if you're, what we have is what are they called? We have like wellbeing plans, my wellbeing plans. So hopefully they'd have been completed, but sometimes it's really helpful to just have a little look and see what has been helpful in the past sometimes, and just being mindful of that when you're navigating around with someone. But again, it's not something we'd do routinely.
Very interesting. It's really nice to hear that your service hasn't just been set up on like some headline, we're going to do things in this sort of way and we're going to do that, and you know, we won't judge you, we'll let you turn up, you give you a cup of tea, but actually you've really got to the core of what it is about sitting with someone where they're at and not being judgmental, not having a head full of stuff that's been said when they're on a ward once and written in their notes and it's there forever for everybody to see.
Yeah, I really like it. I think when I do read notes on someone, it actually causes me more anxiety.
Yeah.
So if I'm having a look at your notes, then I'm probably going to feel more anxious about it. And then that's going to impact the way I talk to you.
Yeah.
Because I'd have picked up on other people's perceptions and judgments rather than just being with you and where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and from a monitoring point of view, something else I'm quite envious of is you clearly have access to whether people you support have used, I think you call them LPS, we call them ALPS, so acute liaison psychiatric services.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I saw there's a like a graphic on the website, and you were basically demonstrating after people had used the retreat, fewer of them went on to use LPS.
We have on our recording forms, which goes on to Rio, so the electronic notes, we'll talk to people when we talk to them. We go, has this conversation or coming here, has it stopped you using going to general hospital, stopped you using crisis services? Has it stopped you coming into contact with the police? So that's how we audit that side of it. Audits, oh, it's not a very nice word, but that's how we review that.
So I can see there's obviously pros and cons, advantages and disadvantages to sort of having NHS link, a strong link like you do have.
Definitely. Definitely pros and cons, but yeah, I think we're very lucky with the team that we have and the support we have to continue to work in this way. And everyone's bought into this. Everyone's really passionate about lived experience, being with the person, the ethos and values everyone's so passionate about from inside the team, and then some of the support systems that we have as well. We're very, very lucky.
Okay, well, Daisy, thanks very much for talking to me. I've really enjoyed finding out about your services.
Yeah, no, it's been really nice to hear about Dalhouse as well. Thank you.
Okay, bye for now then.